From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Each year, about 48,000 children make a perilous journey from Central America to the U.S. to find their mothers. Mothers living in the U.S. as illegal immigrants. Mothers who came here so that they could make money to send home and support their children. On today's Fresh Air, we hear the story of one of those children from journalist Sonia Nazario. Her new book, Enrique's Journey, is expanded from her Pulitzer Prize-winning series published in the Los Angeles Times. Also, critic-at-large John Powers reviews a new DVD edition of John Ford's 1939 classic Young Mr. Lincoln, starring Henry Fonda. John says this portrait of Lincoln is more interesting than you might expect. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
And other possible signs of life at the site of a school. Hundreds of people are missing and feared dead from the mudslide. Douglas Baxton has more from Manila.
U.S. and Malaysian officials say it is not clear whether the sounds come from survivors or from shifting mud covering the elementary school in Ginsogon village. A U.S. military official said something is under the ground because the farther the equipment probes, the stronger the signal grows. A Malaysian team using sound detecting gear also picked up noises. In addition, a sniffer dog stopped several times at one spot away from where rescue workers were digging. Searchers have focused on the school following unconfirmed reports that some of the 300 children and teachers believed trapped inside may have sent text cell phone messages to relatives shortly after the disaster Friday. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Baxton in Manila.
Search crews in Mexico have been digging with picks and shovels today in an effort to reach 65 miners who've been trapped deep underground after an explosion at a coal mine over the weekend. The blast occurred more than 24 hours ago, and the miners had only a six-hour supply of oxygen. Rescuers are not sure if the men are in an area where they may have any access to fresh air. Relatives of the miners have been keeping vigil at the site. In Afghanistan today, hundreds of university students took part in a protest against cartoons of Islam's Prophet Muhammad. They burned American and Danish flags, as well as pictures of President Bush, and they shouted their support for al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden. There were more efforts to ease the furor over the caricatures today. Iran's foreign minister called for an end to the recent violent protests, and Pope Benedict said the world's religions and their symbols should be respected by all. A longer version of an audio tape of bin Laden, originally broadcast last month, was posted to a militant Islamist website today. On the tape, bin Laden insists he will never be captured alive, and he says the U.S. military has become as barbaric as deposed Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's forces. Dale Gavlak has more from Amman.
Bin Laden accused U.S. and allied troops of carrying out the same criminal acts used by Saddam Hussein. He asserted that despite these barbaric methods, his so-called holy warriors are strengthening and increasing in numbers. Bin Laden appears to deny assertions by the Bush administration that Saddam had ties to al-Qaeda, a reason Washington gave for invading Iraq. He also said Washington was trying to muffle any media organization that reports the truth about the losses of U.S. forces in Iraq and Afghanistan. He called President Bush the butcher of freedom and criticized Al Jazeera, saying it was a tool of its host country, Qatar, which he said serves U.S. interests. For NPR News, I'm Dale Gavlak in Amman, Jordan.
This is NPR News. In Iraq today, three bomb attacks by insurgents have killed at least 19 people, breaking a relative lull in violence there. The deadliest attack occurred in central Baghdad, where a suicide bomber detonated a blast on a bus, killing at least a dozen people. Attacks on oil pipelines in Nigeria have sent crude oil prices up to more than $61 a barrel in trading in London. Militants holding nine foreign hostages say they attacked another oil facility today and blew up a military vessel. Nigeria is Africa's leading oil exporter and the fifth largest supplier of petroleum to the United States. President Bush is visiting Wisconsin, Michigan, and Colorado today to promote his energy policy initiatives. Quinn Kleinfelter of Detroit Public Radio has more.
Mr. Bush tours a plant in Milwaukee today that makes batteries for hybrid cars, then heads to a solar panel factory in the Detroit suburb of Auburn Hills. The trips highlight the president's efforts to develop alternative fuels and help end what he calls the nation's addiction to foreign petroleum. The Bush administration also wants to tout the economic advantages of pursuing alternative fuels in a Midwestern area hit hard by losses in manufacturing. The presidential visits come at a time when White House officials hope to turn the nation's attention away from issues like the vice president's hunting accident and the Palestinians' election of Hamas, and back towards the agenda outlined in the recent State of the Union address. For NPR News, I'm Quinn Kleinfelter in Detroit.
Several thousand workers at Sikorsky aircraft plants in Connecticut and Florida went on strike today after rejecting the company's latest contract offer, in large part because it would have forced them to pay higher health insurance costs. It's the first strike at the helicopter manufacturer in more than 40 years. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Calvert, committed to responsible investing and to responsible news broadcasting on NPR. Calvert, investments that make a difference at calvert.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sonia Nazario is a reporter at the Los Angeles Times. A conversation with her housekeeper one day set Nazario off on an investigation that would end up with her writing a Pulitzer Prize-winning series and her new book, Enrique's Journey. Nazario learned that her housekeeper, Carmen, had left her four small children back in Guatemala to come to the U.S. and find a job so that she could send money home to support the children. She hadn't seen her children in 12 years. Carmen's situation turns out to be pretty common. For instance, in Los Angeles, an estimated 4 out of 5 live-in nannies and 1 in 4 house cleaners are mothers who still have at least one child in their home country. And that has led to a new phenomenon. Each year, about 48,000 children from Central America go in search of their mothers in the U.S. It's a perilous journey that often ends with border guards catching the kids and sending them back home. In the new book, Enrique's Journey, Sonia Nazario traces the journey of one Honduran boy who entered the U.S. illegally and now lives and works near his mother in North Carolina. The book is expanded from Nazario's Pulitzer Prize-winning series. For a lot of second- and third-generation Americans, they remember that it was like their grandfather who came first and then sent for the rest of the family. Is this a new trend that it's the mother who's coming first?
Yes. Previously, we saw, particularly in the 60s and 70s, with men from Mexico coming to the United States and leaving behind their wives and their children. But increasingly, as we're seeing family disintegration in Latin America, a lot of women are left without husbands, without partners, for a variety of reasons. And so they are faced with this incredible choice. You know, you talk to these women that talk about not being able to feed their kids more than once a day, about having to fill a glass with water and mix in a daub of tortilla dough to quiet their children when they're crying for food. And so a lot of these women come north, and they think that the separation will be brief. They think it'll be 1 or 2 years, but inevitably it stretches into 5 or 10 years. And so a lot of their children despair, and they want to know, does my mother still love me? And they want to be with her. And many of them say, I'm going to go find her. And there's about 48,000 children who enter the United States alone without a parent every year. And some of those are coming to work, but the great majority, particularly of the Central American children, are coming because they want to find their parent. And most often than not, in 3 in 4 cases, it is a single mother who came north to the United States and left them behind.
Well, you focus on the story of a boy named Enrique, who came to the United States illegally to be with his mother. And he wondered, does my mother still love me? You know, why did she leave me? So he came here to find her and to be with her. How did you decide on Enrique as the person whose story you wanted to tell as an example of this larger phenomenon?
Well, I knew that the majority of children who are detained by Homeland Security, then the INS, the average age was 15 and typically a boy. And Enrique, in many ways, was typical of what these children go through. His mother, Lourdes, left him when he was 5 years old, and he was just bewildered by her absence and then turns increasingly lonely and troubled, and he decides to go out and find her, and he travels the only way that he can with very, very little money, which is clinging to the sides and tops of these freight trains through Mexico. And for him, it's really an epic journey. There are children as young as 7 years old who make this journey alone through Mexico. There are hundreds of people clinging to each of these trains. And he and the other kids have to run this gauntlet, and where they're attacked by gangsters and bandits and corrupt cops, and sometimes the train tears them to bits as well. And so his experiences had been typical, and I found him in northern Mexico, where he had made part of his journey, hoped that he might complete the journey, and then spent some time with him, and then retraced the other parts of his journey that he had already made.
When he decided to come to America to find his mother, what was his mother's life like?
Enrique's mother had lived in Long Beach in California, and she had moved to North Carolina. Basically, a year after she arrives in the United States, she unintentionally gets pregnant. And she's really struggling during much of the 11 years that they are separated. She works at a variety of jobs. She cleans houses. Oftentimes, she's working two or three jobs. At one period, she's only sleeping 4 hours a night to be able to hold down all those jobs. And it's very difficult because she has to support herself and her child in the United States, but she's also working to send money back home to Enrique and his sister. And so it's a daily struggle, and she's also trying to save money to try to become legal in the United States, to try to work with various attorneys or others who promise that they can get her papers. And so at times she lives in a single garage, which the roof leaks, and she's sleeping on a mattress with her child. She has a very, very hard time, and She just prays and prays that someday she can make more money so that she can either bring her children north, or she can make enough so that she can go back to Honduras and have some prospect of a better life for them.
Is her life in America any better than it was in Honduras? Or is her daughter's life, you know, is her child's life any better than the child she left behind?
It's unquestionable that, in an economic sense, her life is better in the United States. That's why so many people come to the United States. Her daughter here is able to go to school. She continues in her schooling. She's able to send enough money so that her daughter in Honduras is able even to attend university and study to become an accountant. So in that sense, her life is better. But it's very difficult being separated from her child. At times, her two children in Honduras, at times she takes care of other people's children. She takes care of the 3-year-old girl of a couple in Beverly Hills. And so she's feeding and caring for other children when she can't do that for her own. And that just is very, very difficult for any mother.
Lourdes left her son Enrique and her daughter in Honduras with her mother, Enrique's grandmother. When Enrique decided to, like, go north to find his mother, did he tell his grandmother that he was leaving?
He did tell his grandmother, but people didn't believe that he was really going to go. And also, without his mother at his side, he had moved from relative to relative, and he had become a very troubled teenage boy. And so there was a part of them that hoped that, you know, he would move on to somewhere else, quite frankly. He was not, you know, the ideal child when he sets off to the United States. He's idealized his mother, and he thinks that being by her side, his troubles will somehow be fixed being with her. So they know that he may be leaving. They don't really believe he's going to leave. But when he does leave, they're very worried about him, and for good reason.
If you're just joining us, my guest is journalist Sonia Nazario. She's a projects reporter for the Los Angeles Times, and her new book, Enrique's Journey, is expanded from a Pulitzer Prize-winning series that she wrote. about children who illegally come to the United States in search of their mothers. Her new book is called Enrique's Journey, the story of a boy's dangerous odyssey to reunite with his mother. How old was Enrique when he left Honduras to come to the United States and find his mother?
Enrique was initially 16 years old when he makes his first attempt. Ultimately, he makes 7 attempts to reach her, and he travels 122 days, and he travels 12,000 miles in his quest to try to reach his mom.
Would you give us an overview of the route that he took?
He starts in Honduras, and he works his way through Honduras and Guatemala on buses. Then he crosses illegally into Mexico. And in southern Mexico, in the most southernmost state, Chiapas, he boards the trains, the freight trains there, and he rides up the length of two-thirds of Mexico, clinging to the tops and sides of these freight trains, which is what many immigrants do, trying to get through Mexico. At one point, he gets off the freight trains, and he hitchhikes from a spot about two-thirds up Mexico to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Now, these freight trains that Enrique rode, that a lot of the young people who tried to illegally enter the United States ride from Central America, they're very dangerous for a lot of reasons, and you know these reasons very well, in part because you rode those trains as part of your research. So let's start with just getting on the train. I mean, you probably didn't have to do this, but the children and teenagers who are illegally riding these trains, they have to jump on them as the trains are moving. Why do they have to do that?
Well, the immigration authorities control the trains, and so they're controlling the train stations. And so the immigrants know that they have to get on and off the trains when they're moving. And that's only really one of the many, many dangers that these children face trying to get through Mexico on these trains. It's a journey, it's a gauntlet that would be amazing for an adult to get through, but it's much more amazing that these children are able to do it. Really, they're hunted like animals all along the way. Most of them are robbed, beaten, the girls are raped along the way. Many of them, this happens to multiple times as they're going through Mexico. Some of these kids are killed in the journey, and they're really surviving on little more than their wits. They have 4 big foes as they head north. They have these gangsters that control the tops of the freight trains, and they have bandits all up and down the sides of the train who are out to rob and rape and kill them. There are these corrupt cops who stop the train and try to grab them and fleece them and deport them back to Mexico's southernmost border. And then there's the train itself, getting on and off these trains as they're moving. And the migrants call the train El Tren de la Muerte, the train of death, because so many of them slip as they're getting on. It's very difficult to get on a moving train. The sides of the train are slanted. The roadbed is slanted at 45 degrees. The ladder comes up to their waist. The train is moving. There are all sorts of migrants crowding around the ladders, jostling to get on the trains. And oftentimes they slip and fall, and they're torn up by the wheels. They're mutilated. They lose arms. They lose legs along the way. So there are all these different things that can harm them as they're trying to work their way north.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sonia Nazario. Her new book is called Enrique's Journey. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sonia Nazario, and she is a projects reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Her new book, Enrique's Journey, is based on a series of Pulitzer Prize-winning articles that she wrote, tracing one immigrant boy's journey from Honduras to the United States to try to meet up with his mother, who had left there years earlier, so that she could send money back home to the children that she left behind. And the book is called Enrique's Journey, The Story of a Boy's Dangerous Odyssey to Reunite with His Mother. And his story is typical of thousands of young people's stories who illegally enter the United States to find their mothers. You mentioned that gangsters control the tops of the trains, and the tops of the trains are one of the main places that that the illegal immigrants ride. So what does it mean that they control the tops of the train? What do they want from? Do they want money in exchange for a place there?
Well, a lot of these gangsters have been deported by the United States back to their home countries in Central America, where the cops are not very kind to them. So they've staked out this turf in southern Mexico and Chiapas. And the train is like any gangster's turf. They divide it up. They divide up routes. And there's usually 10 or 20 of them on any given train. And they go from car to car. They're armed with machetes and knives and bats and sometimes guns. And they'll approach one car. Everyone on the car gets stripped down. They're basically told, give us what you have. Sometimes their clothing and their shoes as well, if they have any coins on them. And if you resist in any way, or they just don't like you because a lot of them are hopped up on crack cocaine or other drugs, they, quote, feed you to the wheels. So they toss you off the train. So it's incredibly dangerous in terms of these gangsters who prowl these trains, mostly in the south of Mexico.
Did you meet up with any of these guys when you tried to replicate Enrique's journey?
Yes, I met up with many gangsters along the way. When I was deciding to do this journey, I tried to build in as many safeguards as possible, but I knew that to really give a vivid account of what it's like for these children coming up on these freight trains, that I would have to go and do this journey myself and ride on top of these freight trains through Mexico. So I did the journey exactly as Enrique had done it. And so where he starts riding on freight trains, I get up on these freight trains, and I ride through two-thirds of Mexico on top of seven freight trains. In the southernmost state, I had armed guards with me who I convinced to go with me. They were with an immigrant rights group, and they came with me along the ride. They had AK-47s and shotguns, but there were still gangsters at the end of my train who were knifing people and robbing people. And oftentimes in the train stations, they would approach me, and I had some hairy experiences with them.
So while you were riding the train, did you always meet young people who were trying to illegally enter America? Are there always immigrants riding those trains?
There are immigrants on every train. The trains in southern Mexico that I rode on had about 100 people. The trains that Enrique rode on had about 200 people on them. Now people talk about how there are 200, 300, 400 people on the trains in southern Mexico. The numbers thin out as you get further north because many of them are caught and deported, or they're harmed in some way and they turn back. And so the numbers do thin out, but there are these, it's an amazing experience to board a train and see these hundreds of people clinging to the sides and tops of these trains, trying to get to America. The train is really, for these immigrants, a living, breathing thing, and they give it names. And some of the more noble names are the Pilgrim's Train, El Tren Peregrino, or they call it the Iron Horse because it will propel them forward to their destination. But the immigrants who know the dark side of the train call it the Train of Death, and those who have been harmed by the train, who have been cut up by the train, call it the Train That Devours.
What are some of the most typical places and some of the most typical ways that these young illegal immigrants are busted on their way to the United States?
Well, oftentimes the immigration authorities in Mexico will stop the train in isolated spots, and they'll do a sweep of the train, and they'll grab them, and they'll line them up, and they'll rob them of their possessions. And sometimes, depending on whether you have enough money to bribe that particular official, you'll be let go or you'll be deported. It often doesn't take much money to be let go. In Enrique's case, it was at times 30, 40, 50 pesos, $3, $4, $5 to be let go. But oftentimes the immigrants don't have it. And so they're caught and they're put on what's called the Bus of Tears, which is what the immigrants call it. It's this bus that picks up immigrants who have been caught up and down Mexico and takes them back to across the southern border and deports them.
So do you think that most of the Mexican officials are corrupt, the ones who deal with illegal immigrants?
My experience and the experience of others who look at this issue in Mexico is that certainly a significant minority of these officials are corrupt, and they do shake them down and then deport them if possible.
And what about the agents on the American side of the Mexican-U.S. border?
The immigrants that I spoke to had a much better opinion of them, of in terms of their honesty and the way that they treat immigrants. That said, as the number of Border Patrol agents is expanding, there are more reports of agents who have been corrupted in terms of allowing immigrants to enter the United States, looking the other way as smugglers pay them to do this. But it's unclear how common that is at this point. But the immigrants have a much better view of U.S. Border Patrol agents than they do of the Mexican counterparts.
So once Enrique, after trying this, like, seven times, he finally makes it into the United States. And then once he gets across the border, now he first has to actually find his mother, who at the time was living, I believe, in North Carolina. It's not like he's ever been to America before. It's not like he knows his way around, and it's not like he has any money. And at one point, he even loses her phone number, doesn't remember her phone number or her address. So how did he actually go about finding her and getting to her once he crossed the border into the U.S.?
Well, when I find Enrique, he's on the Mexican side of the U.S. border across from Texas. And like a lot of children who have arrived to that point, he's been robbed of all his possessions, including the little scrap of paper where he's written the phone number to his mother. And that's all he really has. And all he knows is that he's supposed to keep going north and asking people, and eventually, hopefully, he'll get pointed the way of North Carolina. So he's lost that phone number, but unlike a lot of these other children who have no way of calling back to their home countries because there's no telephone in their villages, he has one phone number he can call, get the number again to his mother, and try to continue his journey north. So he calls her, and she agrees to help him at that point obtain the services of a smuggler to help him get across the U.S. border.
Sonia Nazario is the author of Enrique's Journey. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, available in stores and online at bn.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, with the new website at macfound.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Enrique finds his mother. We continue our conversation with journalist Sonia Nazario. And John Powers reviews the new DVD edition of John Ford's 1939 classic film, Young Mr. Lincoln. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Sonia Nazario. Her new book, Enrique's Journey, is expanded from her Pulitzer Prize-winning series of articles in the Los Angeles Times. It follows a teenage boy from Honduras who travels thousands of miles to find his mother in the U.S. His mother was working in the U.S. as an illegal immigrant. Like many illegal immigrants, she came here to get a job so she could send money back home to her children. When we left off, Nazario was describing what happened when Enrique finally made it to the U.S.-Mexico border. He'd been robbed of all his possessions. He phoned his mother in the States, and she agreed to send him money for a smuggler to help him get across the border. And how do the smugglers work?
Smugglers work depending on how much money you have. If you have a lot of money, you can pay them to go through the official entrances to the United States. And there are people who are willing to drive you with a certain type of papers from the United States of another person to enter that way. That's the most expensive way to get in. Other people walk into the United States and they pick you up with a car. There are safe houses on the other side where you can hide if the authorities are tracking you. But oftentimes you get caught coming in. But many times what Enrique does is he contracts with a smuggler who he's been living with on the Rio Grande, and he knows the guy has a good track record. A lot of smugglers will take your money and leave you stranded, but he's seen this guy take people across the river, swim across the river with them, and then he has two other smugglers who meet him in their SUV a few blocks across from the river, and they get into the car and they drive to where close to where there's a highway checkpoint. And there they get down from the car, and the smuggler walks them around the checkpoint, and then the SUV picks them up on the other side of the checkpoint. So it depends on how much you're willing to pay in terms of how much walking you'll have to do. There are differing rates, whether you're going to walk 1 hour, 12 hours through the desert, 24 hours through the desert, or you're literally going to come across in a car from Mexico to the United States through an official checkpoint.
While you were trying to replicate Enrique's journey from Honduras to the United States as an illegal immigrant, you met a lot of children who were taking that route. Did you do anything? Like, what were your ethical guidelines about whether you should help them in any way? Give them food, give them directions, help them call relatives, help them call their mothers in the United States. I mean, there's a lot potentially that you could have done, but that would have been kind of changing the story. So how did you figure out what you thought was the most appropriate way to behave?
Journalists really don't want to go into a situation and change the situation. You want to go in and describe reality, describe the truth of something to people. And so I try to intervene as little as possible. And generally, my rule was not to intervene. And that was very, very hard because 20 or 30 times a day, I would have an immigrant ask me for money or ask me for something. And largely, I did not help people. But there were times that I did intervene. And my drawing line was if I felt that someone was in imminent danger. And if I helped them, oftentimes they could not be a part of the story because I felt that I had changed the story in that way. So there were moments like that where I did intervene, but there were moments where I really didn't. Enrique is in Mexico, and he's struggling mightily to come up with $10 so he can buy a phone card and call Honduras to get the phone number to his mother, which he's lost on his journey. And he washes cars, and oftentimes he goes 24 hours without eating. And he's really having a hard time, and I have a cell phone in my purse. I do not give him my cell phone because I know that that will really change the story in a fundamental way. I do track him very carefully to see, is he eating once a day? And I know all the safety nets that he has, the church that's helping him, this person that's helping him. And when he hasn't eaten for 24 hours, those are the moments that I choose to take him to McDonald's and we do our big sit-down interviews. So I try to be sensitive to the situation, but also knowing that I can't change what's happening.
In your book, you explain that a lot of the children who idealize their mothers after their mothers leave them in their home country then go out in search of their mothers. But once they find their mothers, their mothers are no longer the ideal that they had in their fantasy. And there's resentment and anger at the mother for having left them. The mothers are no longer that familiar with the children, so it takes time for them to really get to know their children again. And things don't always go so well in those relationships. How did Enrique and his mother get along when he finally made it to her home?
Well, these children really, Enrique really does idealize his mother. A lot of these children talk about, you know, how they smell their mother's clothes, they look at her photo, they try to remember what she looks like, and they see her as someone who will fix whatever problems have arisen in their life with her not there, their side to protect them or to help them in different ways. But when they reach the United States, after these long separations, Enrique doesn't see his mother for 11 years. And so when Enrique arrives, there's this brief honeymoon. And unfortunately, he has all these resentments that arise in him because he feels like she abandoned him. She left him. She said she would be back in a year or two, and she didn't come back. And so he really goes into this spiral and gets into a lot of trouble again. But he feels that his mother should get down on both knees and apologize to him for leaving him. And his mother, Lourdes, just can't do that. She struggled through so much, and she felt that she's done this all for him and his sister, to provide them with a better life, with a chance to eat, with a chance to study, for the things that she didn't have as a child. And so she just can't go there, and so they come to this impasse. And unfortunately, what happens with a lot of these families, these millions and millions of families in the United States, is that these women lose the love of their children, and they lose what's most important to them, which is this, you know, in any culture, but particularly in Latino culture, the family unity. And it's not a happy ending in many cases. And a lot of these children are in these conflicted homes, and they try to find that love that they thought they were going to find with their mother elsewhere. And some of the experts on gangs, for example, in Honduras and in the United States, say that there's a disproportionate number of gang members who come from homes where the mother left them behind for a time, and there were these family separations, because they're trying to find that love elsewhere.
When Enrique gets to his mother's place, you know, he's cursing a lot. He starts drinking more and more. He's smoking a lot of marijuana. And this is all very upsetting to his mother. She tries to talk him out of it, but she really has no authority over him. She has no control over him. And he makes that really clear to her. So how does his presence change her life for better or worse?
Well, she's guilt-ridden, because she wonders if he would have turned out this way had she stayed by his side. She wonders, how would he have turned out differently if I would have stayed in Honduras? And she sees him spiraling, and she just can't get it into his head that she did this because she loved him so much and she wanted something better for him. And so they come to a point where she literally tells him, you know, either you have to shape up and stop doing these horrible things that you're doing, or you have to get out of my house. And so they're faced with the prospect of possibly living apart again.
When Enrique comes north, he leaves his girlfriend in Honduras, and she's pregnant with his child. She gives birth. When the book ends, she's starting to come north to try to be with Enrique, leaving their daughter behind, as Enrique's mother left him behind. Where are they now? Where's the daughter, and where's Enrique's girlfriend?
I don't really want to go beyond what the book says in terms of their lives, but to say that he is happy with his mother, and the girlfriend does make it to the United States, but I don't really, in terms of their privacy, and I'd prefer to leave it where the book ends.
I was surprised that Enrique was willing to leave his daughter behind in Honduras, given how resentful he was that his mother left him behind.
He thinks that he'll be able to leave her behind for a short period of time, and that he won't let it stretch out into years as his mother did. He thinks he'll do things differently, that somehow in the near future they'll be able to bring her north, or they'll be able to go back to Honduras together, but that unlike his mother, he will not make the same mistakes as his mother. He will not allow years and years and years to pass before he's able to see his daughter.
Is Enrique working now?
Enrique is working now. He paints houses. He lives with his mother, near his mother. He goes to her every morning, and he gives her a big hug, and she gives him a cup of coffee. And he's gotten past his resentment, and he's allowed the strong love that he felt towards her all his life to move ahead of the resentment that he's really felt towards her these years. And so they really love each other.
My guest is Sonia Nazario. Her new book is called Enrique's Journey. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Sonia Nazario. Her new book, Enrique's Journey, follows a Honduran boy who makes a perilous journey to the U.S. to find his mother, an illegal immigrant who came here to get a job so she could send money back home to her children. Let's talk a little bit about immigration policy now. You describe our policy now as schizophrenic. What do you mean by that?
It is schizophrenic in the sense that we continue to build up the U.S. border in terms of immigrants being able to enter the United States illegally. But once those immigrants are in the United States, in terms of any kinds of raids on businesses or any kind of enforcement on businesses who hire workers illegally, it's gone from sporadic enforcement to virtually no enforcement. So basically, once you're in the country, you're home free.
The House passed a bill in December on immigration. What does this new proposed bill that the House passed say?
Well, the House is largely looking at they're looking to bolster border enforcement. So they're looking, for example, to build a 700-mile-long fence along the U.S.-Mexico border to reinforce the border, to add more border patrol guards and the like.
The House bill also calls for increasing the penalty for illegal entry into the United States and for imposing criminal penalties on churches and social service groups that help undocumented workers. And church and social service groups are very opposed to this. Do you think that the Senate is likely to pass a similar bill?
It's unclear whether they'll pass a similar bill. The Senate is also focused on obtaining a temporary worker program, and they're less focused than the House on these kind of measures that try to penalize illegal immigrants and penalize those who help them or employ them. So this issue is going to come up before the Senate in March and be debated, the competing bills, but ultimately the Senate and the House will have to reconcile their versions. And it looks like the House is adamantly opposed to a temporary worker program. So what may happen is that the issue will once again be tabled. But the issue is building in terms of its importance to the American public. Two-thirds of Americans believe that there is too much immigration to the United States. So there is pressure building on the Senate and the House to do something.
Well, President Bush has said that he wants a guest worker or a temporary worker plan to be a central part of any new immigration law. And he said that this program could match workers with willing employers on jobs that Americans won't do, and that this would help Border Patrol agents focus on criminals as opposed to focusing on job seekers. Would you describe the president's proposal?
The president wants to allow immigrants who are in the United States illegally to apply to work legally for 3 years and then reapply to work for another 3 years, so a total of a six-year program. The concern is that a lot of immigrants will not apply for the program because they know that after 6 years they may be kicked out. And so it would be easier to just continue to work illegally in the United States, especially if there are few sanctions for doing so. So there's a concern about whether it will really work, and there's a concern about how this would affect Native workers in the United States, people born here, in terms of, again, their wages and their ability to obtain some of these same jobs in construction, as mechanics. It's clear that some jobs, for example, in agriculture, there are some jobs that it is very difficult to find Native workers who are willing to do them. They are just such heinous jobs. And Enrique's mother, Lourdes, talks about doing some of those jobs. She sometimes cleans homes where there have a suicide has been committed, and she has to clean that up. There are jobs that she feels strongly that there are Native people born in the United States that don't want to do those jobs. But again, the House is largely seems to be opposed. Republicans in the House seem to largely be opposed to President Bush's plan. So it's unclear whether it will go forward or not.
Why is the Republican Party divided over immigration reform, and what are those divisions about?
Some Republicans believe that the past immigration reforms allowed certain number of people, millions of immigrants, to become legal with the promise that there would be a clampdown in terms of employer sanctions on those who hired illegal immigrants. And that what came about was the first part of the equation, but the second part of the equation was never acted upon truly by the federal government. There's a part of the Republican Party that says, we want to see border enforcement first. Don't talk to us about guest worker programs, temporary worker programs, or any kind of amnesty at this point. We need to see that the federal government is willing to really enforce our laws in the United States in terms of illegal immigration. Another part of the Republican Party believes that you have to have a comprehensive approach to illegal immigration, that you just can't cut off who's coming now. You have to deal with the 11 million folks who are in the United States illegally right now. You need to bring those people out of the shadows and provide them some path to either become temporarily legal or permanently legal ultimately. And so that's what the fight is about. Do we allow people in this country illegally to have a path to become legal? Do we reward, as some Republicans believe, lawbreakers? Or do we just build a fence, provide more enforcement, and keep any new immigrants, illegal immigrants, out? It's a huge issue because there are 700,000 immigrants coming to the United States illegally every year, and there are a million who come to the United States legally or become residents of the United States every year. That's a lot of people, and it's changing communities around the country. And a lot of people see many of the positives of those changes, but there are obviously also negatives to those changes as well. It's more an issue of who benefits and who doesn't from that flow.
Finally, I'm wondering how writing this book and writing the Pulitzer Prize series that preceded it changed your views on immigration in the United States.
I think what most stunned me was the gritty determination of people to make it to this country. I'd been in many countries, but I really didn't at heart understand the factors that are driving people out of these countries, how they live. What really struck me was that in order for this to truly change, this has to be addressed at its source. The other thing that really struck me going through Mexico was not only the cruelty that's visited on these people, but the incredible kindness that's visited upon these immigrants in some of these places in Mexico. There are these villages where the train slows either for a curve or to pass through a village, and there are people who come out to the tracks, and many of these people earn $1 or $2 a day, and they barely have enough food to feed themselves or to feed their children. And oftentimes you'll see 20 or 30 people coming out as the train is approaching, and they'll wave to the immigrants on the train, and they'll bring out these bundles that they'll throw to the immigrants on the train. And it's oftentimes a little bit of bread or a tortilla or whatever fruit is in season, or a plastic bottle of water. Or if they don't have anything at all, they'll come out and they'll give a prayer to the people coming by on the train. And sometimes these immigrants who haven't eaten for days coming through Mexico, they haven't had water in a long time, And they'll sob when these bundles land in their arms as they're passing through these villages on these trains. It's an incredibly moving experience to see those sorts of things, to see people who give, who have nothing to give, but they give what the little they have.
Well, Sonia Nazario, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Sonia Nazario is the author of the new book, Enrique's Journey. Coming up, John Powers reviews the new DVD edition of the 1939 film Young Mr. Lincoln. This is Fresh Air. Just in time for President's Day, John Ford's 1939 classic film Young Mr. Lincoln has been released on a new two-disc DVD edition by the Criterion Collection. The film stars Henry Fonda. Our critic-at-large John Powers says that this portrait of Honest Abe is more fascinating than you might expect.
When I was a kid, American history class specialized in mythology. You know, made-up tales like George Washington's encounter with that cherry tree. Airbrushed by legend, our nation's presidents came to seem like the looming stone faces on Mount Rushmore. Heroic, grand, all but untouchable. Which is why my favorite was always Abraham Lincoln, who also came shrouded in mythic apparatus, log cabins and rail splitting and speeches written on envelopes, but whose sad eyes hinted at complexity, vulnerability, and soulfulness. That's not a happy face you see on your $5 bill. Oddly enough, one of the most strikingly ambivalent portraits of the great emancipator came in a Hollywood movie, Young Mr. Lincoln, which was just released on a new DVD. It was made in 1939 by director John Ford, whose works are routinely described as classics. Young Mr. Lincoln is a classic in that sense. It's one of the great American movies. But it's classic in another way, too, in the clarity of its vision. No movie about an American president has ever been less sanctimonious or sentimental. Abe Lincoln is played by a skinny 34-year-old Henry Fonda, who sports a prosthetic nose and the distant homespun manner that came to define the actor. It defines Lincoln, too. We watch Abe's transformation from a sweet-natured young man not quite sure of his ambition to a canny, politics-minded lawyer who, in the major storyline, defends two poor young farmers accused of killing a nasty sheriff's deputy. Along the way, we get a snapshot of mid-19th century America in its social extremes, from the cheerful sociability of a pie-baking contest, Abe has trouble choosing between the peach and the apple, to the fury of that same community forming a lynch mob, forcing Lincoln to stand between his neighbors and the men they would hang. It's Lincoln's gift that he's able to use his folksy manner and easy wit to pragmatic ends. Here, for example, his questioning of a prospective juror at the farmer's murder trial winds up with him zinging the well-known local D.A.
You say you've never discussed this case.
No, sir, I never did.
Ever hear anybody else discuss it?
No, sir.
How long you been a barber in this town?
Oh, about 18 years going on.
And you never heard it mentioned?
No, sir, not that I remember.
Do you know the gentleman who's prosecuting this case, Mr. Felder?
I guess I know him.
Then you're excused.
Your Honor, this is a waste of time. Mr. Lincoln should know that the mere fact that a prospective juror knows counsel for the state does not disqualify him.
I know that, John. What I'm afraid of is that some of the jurors might not know you, and that'd put me at a great disadvantage.
Abraham Lincoln was nothing if not clever, And though the film is clearly on his side, it doesn't make Honest Abe a conventional hero. Instead, he's a folksy-seeming man who stands apart from the people, who think of him as one of them. Ford emphasizes this by playing up Lincoln's distinctive appearance, the stovepipe hat and black suit that make him look like a sinister, if dapper, scarecrow. And this sense of Lincoln's exceptionalism is reinforced by Fonda, whose eerily acute performance often finds him staring into space or lost in hermetic ruminations. Where the characters around Lincoln all seem like 19th century types, he's a profoundly modern figure, at once brooding and filled with a sly sense of showbiz. Possessed of a self-consciousness miles beyond anybody else's, this Lincoln appears to be caught somewhere between his own common humanity and his own destiny as a great man. While young Mr. Lincoln is worth seeing at any time, it has a special resonance on President's Day, especially in this hysterical era when our presidents, like all politicians, are routinely reviled as liars, crooks, and unprincipled compromisers. Some politicians are corrupt or stupid, of course. But Ford's film reminds us that even the greatest of our presidents had his cold, almost monstrous side. Even when absolutely sincere, he was also calculating. He used his self-deprecation and good-humored folksiness to manipulate the world into doing what he wanted, not to mention pushing himself forward. Lincoln did what politicians must do, and watching Fonda's performance, you sometimes feel you're seeing a template for the successful presidential runs of the Gipper, the Man from Hope, and George W. Bush. We often think of the past as being more naive than our own wised-up times, but no contemporary political movie offers a more unsettling image of public life than the next-to-last scene of young Mr. Lincoln. The trial is over, and Lincoln's inside the courthouse. "The crowd is waiting," someone cries to him, and the courthouse door swings open. Lincoln stands there, starkly lighted, all in black, preparing to meet the roaring mob that's eager to embrace him. In Fonda's face, at once still and disconcerted, we can picture everything that will follow. The White House, the Civil War, Ford's Theater. We sense the terrible swift sword that is power.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. He reviewed the new DVD edition of Young Mr. Lincoln. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shura. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of The Train to Lo Wu, a collection of stories set in modern-day Hong Kong by Jess Rowe. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life, online at pewtrusts.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Well, the next Fresh Air, Michael McKean. He co-starred in the mockumentaries This is Spinal Tap, A Mighty Wind, and Best in Show. He played Lenny in the 70s sitcom Laverne and Shirley. Now McKean's co-starring in the Broadway revival of The Pajama Game. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.